I believe we are.
Somebody here?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I better put on the britches.
Might be not.
Demonstration.
Well, you demonstrated.
Yeah, about didn't ever get it off, so. You know, that's one of those odd ones where the nuts go the other way to come off.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know that. I thought they all went one way. Mm-hmm. So I got on that wrench, and I was tightening the whole time. You know? I thought it was the damnedest thing. Somebody cranked them on there so hard, I just never get them off.
Yeah.
So I kept cranking one, and I crank another, and I crank another. And Miss Mary is over there looking at me. She says, "Well, Rick, I believe you're going the wrong way." And I didn't want to admit it because I've changed tires before. I know what I'm doing. So I just kept on cranking. I decided, well, I'll just stay on one nut for a while and just keep turning it. So I started doing that. She says, "I still believe you're going the wrong way."
You're tightening them.
Okay, Miss Mary. So I start going the other way, and sure enough, it is right on.
Oh, is it right there in the yard?
Yeah. Yeah. Miss Steve was sitting there under the tree.
She wasn't worrying.
No, she was just kind of taking it all in.
It's you, Miss Mary said about her.
No.
She had an explosion. She may have told you about that with Marvin.
No!
Oh, Lord.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Oh. I thought maybe you'd just gotten that. She said, I sat down and what's her name, Minnie Bell or Lua Bell? I think it's Minnie. Yeah, I think it's Minnie Bell.
Minnie Bell, I didn't get that.
Well, anyway, she went to the bathroom and Miss Mary said, she said, while she's still in there.
Now, please sit over there where you won't get on my feet. Just move over just a little bit.
She said...
I'm leaning against this. The chair won't stand up.
She said that... she says, "Suzanne, my nerves are just going all to pieces." She says, "I'm just having a nervous breakdown." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And she says, "I don't know what it is." She says, "I snap at Marvin every time he comes close to me." She said, "Marvin had never mistreated me. I know he had never mistreated me. And when I was so sick, I'd get in the tub and he'd come in and he'd bathe me and wash my back." And she said, "Lately I won't even let him in the bathroom with me." And she said, I just sit there in a tub of hot water and cry and cry and cry. And she said, I just exploded. It had to bust out. And I told Marvin, I said, "I've got to have somebody stay with me." So they went over and picked up Minnie Bell, Miss D. And she'd gone to the bathroom. Miss Mary said under her breath, "Hey, she's about to drive me crazy."
She brings it out. She brings it out.
She brings
I think
it out.
It's two of a kind.
I think they are two of a kind.
Yeah.
I think
one of them really squat and short, and the other is lanky and bright eyed, but they still two of a kind.
Driving me crazy. I can see why. That woman sat in there, and for an hour she did not say a word. She just sat there and she chewed on her fingernails. And she'd tie her shoes and untie her shoes. And she's like me. She'd get her leg up in the chair like this.
Under her chin.
Yeah, under her chin. And when she finally did start talking, it's about her chihuahuas. And about, I don't know how we got on this. Milk, that's what it was. They've got that cow out there. The calf can't drink enough milk.
Yeah.
She says she doesn't like milk. Just plain milk. She says, "I like chocolate milk." but it stops me up. We got on this discussion about fruit and what it did for you.
Minnie Bell.
Minnie Bell, I think, or Lulu Bell. I'm not really sure.
I know I heard her first name. I remember her well. After we sat there half an hour, she was there the day we went in, right while Miss Mary was cooking and performing one Sunday. Her brother was there and somebody else, and they're out there working on the car, and the rest of them were around sitting on the floor in the kitchen. Faye was, I came in showing you, and Miss Mary was performing. Mm. And she was there, Minnie Bell was there. I remember that. But she didn't have much chance while we were there that particular Sunday. Yeah. But while Rick and I were there, she performed.
Did she?
Oh, she performed. She said they hadn't proved to her yet that they had got to the moon. She says her son had been out there in California. And he says along there in Arizona there's a lots of places that look just like the moon.
Well, I believe that because they got talking about education.
Yeah.
Mm. Telling children the facts of life in school, and she said she wouldn't tell her children anything. She didn't know anything till she got married, and she didn't see why they had to know anything till they were married. But she, while I was there, she didn't say much. You know,
but oh, that's funny.
Miss Mary did most of the talking.
Oh, did she? Yeah. But she talked Miss Mary down while we were there.
Yeah, she got on the tobacco. And guy said he'd use better form tobacco except snuff. She said, well, I think that's what I like best of all, snuff. She says, but now you give me chawing tobacco. You just give me a plug of day's work and put me on the riverbank with a fishing pole and let me sit there with my stack and I'm perfectly happy. She says, now I've got a piece there in my tackle box. I just keep it wrapped up in wax paper and stays nice and fresh. She says, now it's plain truth. I like it and I'm going to tell you I do.
Well, if she can talk Miss Mary down, that may be why she's driving her crazy.
But she did while we were there, didn't she?
Sure.
All Miss Mary did, she asked me about Mr. Cook. And that's how it got on that. I said he didn't have anything on one side. And had a little spot or two on the other. But he was still smoking. Doctor said it didn't affect what he had. And I said, you know, I said, I was damn right smoke. Smoking wasn't my choice either. I'd used tobacco in every form, but I thought chewing was my choice. And then she picked it up. She did it. Yes, sir. She just had that day's work right in front of her, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Miss Mary's having it out with Marvin's family is why she's so nervous, she said.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. We cried it out. She and Marvin exploded.
Yeah.
Oh, she exploded.
And she exploded. Well, what it was, she said, she went through the long thing. It started with the wedding, Leroy's wedding.
Something like that.
Yeah. She said, Christine, Leroy's mother? I think. Well, anyway, it was either Christine or Ella May. One of them called her up. She asked them what they should wear. And they said, well, nothing fancy. You know, you don't have to wear a hat or gloves or anything like that, or no jewelry. So she showed up, and she didn't have a hat, she didn't have gloves, she didn't have jewelry. She said, now I just bought me a pair of white gloves, but they told me not to wear them. She got to the church, and she said, everybody was all dutied up. She said, and it hurt my feelings so bad. She called Christine, I think it was. I said, why didn't you tell me to wear gloves? And Christine says, well, I said you could wear them if you wanted to. And Miss Mary says, that's not what you told me. You said they weren't going to wear them. You said they're just going to dress like they're going to town. And she said, and it hurt my feelings so bad, I don't know if I'm going to get over it. So that was one thing. And then Snow, oh, this is how Ella Mae got it. Snow's having an operation. And Miss Mary offered to go down with Ella Mae and stay with her while Snow was having this operation. And Ella Mae said, no, that's all right. Gladys is coming with me.
You said a little bit far back.
She said, that's all right. Gladys is coming with me. And Miss Mary says, Gladys hadn't done a thing for Ella Mae. I let Ella Mae drive my car around, and I go into town with her. And when she's a little girl, I took care of her. I gave her home and let her stay here when she's a little girl. And Gladys hadn't done a thing for her, and she just told me she wanted Gladys to come with her. She didn't want anything to do with me. That's the second thing. So she's at outs with Marvin's family. And then she got at outs with Marvin because B.F. Rutledge, she had to go way back to this. He's drunk, she said. And she took him in one time, she and Mr. Guthrie, and said that he could live with them and work with them. And she said, but as long as he didn't get drunk, because the first time she saw him drunk around their place, she's going to kick him out. Well, she said, Marvin and Mr. Guthrie are out the field, and there was B.F. lying in the house, flat on his back in the bed, just sleeping it off. She went out and got Mr. Guthrie and said she wasn't going to have it. So they asked him to leave. She said he peed on my best bed. I had to draw it out. She sent him packing and told his sister that she wasn't having BF around her ass anymore. They got into town Friday to cash Marvin's check, and there's BF in front of the store. He said, Marvin, he says, why don't you leave Mary here and take me down to this nigger's house? He owes me $12.50, and he's going to pay it. Miss Mary says, nuh-uh. I ain't staying here. She said, I wanted to see where they were going. So she got in the car with him, and they drove this fella's house. And she told BF, she said, now if you get in a fight, you start.
You got a sparrow, or what is that?
You got chased off now.
I don't believe it's sparrow.
Huh?
She said, if you get in a fight, you're going to walk back to Hawthorne. Well, he didn't get in a fight. He got tanked up on whiskey. He got his belly tanked up with whiskey. They drove him back to town. She let him back in the car, and they drove back to town, and she said, and Marvin opened his big mouth. She said, he wasn't thinking what he was saying. He said, BF, why don't you go down to the university and get you a job out there? And BF said, okay. He says, I'll come by your house, and I'll pay you $50 a month, and Marvin and I can ride in back and forth to the university together. Miss Mary said, oh. Said, that sap sucker ain't coming to my house. But she got mad, you know. She told BF, she says, you're not going to stay at my house. And then when they got off a ways, she told Marvin, and she wasn't going to have him. She got home, and she said, there's no telling what BF was going to say to his sister. Evidently, BF's been marrying, divorced, I think. I'm not sure. But anyway, nobody lets him live at their house, none of his relatives. And she called the sister. She called Mrs. Rutledge. And she said, now, BF is likely to say anything to you. She She said, but I ain't having him. She says, I got nothing against BF. He's never done anything to me. But I'm not going to have a 55-year-old drunk laying up around my house. And Mrs. Rutledge agreed. She said, BF is too old. He's not going to get a job. He's not going to hold it. She doesn't know what he's going to do with himself. He hadn't got any place to live. He's too sorry to look for a place. She says, I don't blame you. I wouldn't have him either. Yeah, that's his sister. And they used to live over in the Dodds place. Worked there, I think.
Oh.
A long time ago. I didn't get all the
maybe when they were growing up.
Yeah, I think. So I think that's what led to the explosion with Marvin, where she just, you know, she didn't say what she told him, but it ended up she wasn't going to stay in the house by herself. She wanted somebody to stay with her, and came up with Mrs. D.
Now, were you in all this? No, that's
no. This is for you.
That was before I got there.
And then she got on to you, because you didn't believe Revelation.
No, I didn't say that. I said I didn't believe it was something else.
In the mark of the beast.
Yeah, there's something else.
Yeah.
I got to sit on that.
Okay.
Let me tell you, after the wedding that night, she didn't go to reception. She went to Ruby's.
Yeah, I remember talking about that. She and...
Were you here? And she and Marvin got in with Lovett and Duty.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a pair. And then that is what led... Now, she didn't bring any, them in on anything.
No, not on what she was telling me over there.
Or over here either.
No, just...
But that led to the other thing that... Louise called her up the other day.
Oh yeah, and fell over there getting married?
Yeah.
I can't think of his name, yeah.
Theo.
Yeah, Theo.
So all of that, she couldn't stay at the wedding, she didn't have the gloves, and I wondered how in the world she didn't go to the reception and why she'd come over here to the Ruby's. I still don't know why she'd come to Ruby's.
Well, she felt evidently real bad about that glove business, because everybody was all dressed up. Now, she said, I didn't have the money to go out and buy a new dress, but I could have bought something, and I had the gloves. And she showed up there and looked out of place. And then she got her sense of humor back later on, and she said what they'd done to the car, Leroy's car. It got sardines.
Oh.
And smeared sardines and sardine juice all over the engine and all over the car and the front seat and jacked it up and tied cans and full rolls of toilet paper. But the sardines were the worst, because when you turned the engine off, it started eating up.
Oh.
She thought that was funny.
And she laughed. She chuckled.
Yeah. Yeah, she does it under her breath. She doesn't come out and laugh out loud. Yeah. She just sort of starts laughing and shit.
Yeah.
Of course, when she got married, Marvin parked the car out where they could get to it easy.
Yeah.
And they used lipstick, and the preacher came out and told them they oughtn't to be doing that, marking up their car. And Miss Weaver says, "Oh, you don't know what's going on," to the preacher. And Ms. Weaver from Citrus, she got out a crayon and she started marking on it, you know, and just saying things like, "You're going to get hell tonight," and some just comments like that all over the car. With tin cans and all.
Ms. D's got a daughter named Wanda.
Yeah, Wanda, evidently she's something.
Yes, we're going to hear about her. Yeah.
Miss D says that she has learned more about life and sex from Wanda since Wanda started school than she ever knew in her life.
Oh.
And Miss Mary says, "Well, I'm glad Wanda was a little younger when I got married." And she got into the car and no telling what it'd be on it. I think she must like Wanda. She wants her to come stay with her when she gets out of school.
Yeah, that's what.
And she asked me if my school was out yet.
I'll obviously put up with you.
I think that'd drive her crazy after a while, too.
She went on and on about Wanda while we were there. Said Wanda was a tomboy. She'd go out and hunt and fish with the best of the men. Had her own gun. And squirrel season, she'd bring home the best squirrels they'd ever eaten. Said all her youngins had moved out now. And married and had own homes, but all left their guns at home. But Wanda had hers up in a room. Said she'd go fishing. So she'd get a rifle and go off in the woods and go hunting.
Yeah. Like her daddy.
Yeah. Like her daddy.
Well, she's the one. You remember that first time I went over there, and Miss Mary talked about Joel Smith going fishing with Snow and Ella Mae, and Wanda had gone too, and she's the one who made the comment about Joel fishing. I think that was her.
Wanda?
Yeah, Wanda. I think. She'd gone with him.
I asked Shirley kind of how somebody could work in with John Henry, go out with him, and then come back in, you know, when they're working on fish, and talk with him, hear him talk. He talked Blue Streak. Well, this much is perfect, sir. Ain't nobody going out with them. They put them nets where they want them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They don't want any talk about where they do that. Mm-hmm. So that's out. Mm-hmm. But after they get the fish in, I think if they get over there early enough to see, they can pick up.
Yeah.
Somebody pick up with them. Maybe skin a few fish or whatever you do, and maybe John Henry. But she says they just don't want company. They don't care for company. If you ask them for a favor, they'll come and do it in still a minute, and away they're going.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah. John Henry, I thought maybe we could get a hold of him. He's gallant. He's gallant. He has that light touch way back. See, golly, such civility. And he don't wear a shirt or shoes or a belt. He wears them old jeans. He's got those fast movements. And that hair goes right back, you see, like a judge.
Just one time he talked to me for a little while.
Now you see, you're caught down flat-headed all the people. people come out here. They sit back and wait for me to say something. And talk something.
Hi.
This is Miss Mary. We getting ready to leave. Suzanne had to go in the house to pick up her purse. So I looked over the roof and I said, you got that roof all done there. That you do a pretty good job of that. She says, oh, no. No, you know what they did? They started that thing. And so then they left it for about 3 weeks. And so it come and rain all over my kitchen floor. And it was just the most perfect mess you've ever seen all around the house. It ruined all the tile on my floor, in my kitchen. So then I had to call them to come back out there. And it was in the contract that they wouldn't do that to me. They would just get it all done at once. It wouldn't leave me like that. But no, they went off and they left me for 3 weeks. And they said it cost me $1,966 to have that roof fixed. And you know, I had to have them come out here 3 times to fix that molding on the side. So they just put in little bitty pieces, and it was all jaggedy and raggedy. She said she called them up, and she asked them what they were going to do about her kitchen floor. And he said, well, you know, I think you ought to be satisfied, because we've been out there twice at our own expense to fix those moldings. I said, well, you know, that was in the contract. And she says, well, before I pay you, aren't you going to come out here and look at this? And he says, yeah, we'll be out there. So they came out in about an hour. She said, I told them what I thought about it, and I gave them peace of my mind. And she said, then the very men that put the shingles on that roof came out there and had the gumption to ask her about putting the siding on the house. They wanted $1,500 to put the siding on the house. And she asked him, he said, you know you left me in a mess when you did that roof. And they said, yeah. He says, now you're going to come out here and ask me to put the siding on, and I know you're going to leave me in a mess again. And they go, well. And so she told them off too, and sent them running.
Shirley thinks her car's running.
She didn't say anything about the car.
Yeah.
I mentioned she didn't pick it up.
It must be. I hope she doesn't have car trouble on top of all the other trouble she's had. Yeah.
Well, you know, when I go over there and I listen to her again, it makes, you know, just writing about her sounds so flat. there's nothing that takes care of the voice that she's got, just that liveliness.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Just absolutely, and it seems kind of ridiculous to sit down and even, you know, even try to put it on paper, because it's.
And you can see her turn her head,
yeah,
and start chuckling before she comes out with something.
I was just saying, the more I get into that, you know, lighting, that part of it, it just seems like the only way you can go is further away from her. I know that's the problem, to make her real and yet still put something in and maybe do it lightly, but have it there so somebody knows what you're talking about.
I think it's easier than this. People's ears are just going to stop flapping. What was that? The structure can come from experience. Let me see. I can't recapture it. It was one of the, it was, I think it was the little girl at the office. Maybe it was. I can't recapture it now, but I had it in my mind. the structure can come from the experience. I'll have to, let me see. Now, they used to, the students used to hand me a poem and want me to read it and just hand it to me. And they expect me to see, to read like Shakespeare. They didn't know what they had, so they couldn't tell me. And I didn't know what they had in it, and I was pretty sure they didn't have much of anything. They didn't know what they were doing. And I got after them there for so much, and said so much, they don't hand me a poem anymore. But you see, just like a picture, it ought to have, they ought to tell you what the hell they're doing in it. See, the only way I know what Emily Dickinson is doing is by reading Charles Anderson. Well, I don't think you need quite that much. I think just a little statement would do it. Now, I think this thing of yours that you're giving Mr. Herkesheimer. Kurt Patrick. You're taking advantage of him. You're asking him to respond to something that he has no experience in, that is entirely out of his line. And you're going to have to give him the critical view of it that would enable him to see it. And my view, it would be very simple. Here is all that's left of the old world in the southeast part of Alachua County. Someone who's been brought up with space and has all those magnificent old manners pressed by a bunch of crooks from Sears. And she's got no defense against them.
Well, she's
at the end, you see that old world, even so, come to the surface when she sits back and that rambler seat comes to her mind. And it's a beautiful thing, and it is filled with urgency. What in the hell are you going to do about it? Are you just going to let the old world burn? I think it's got to have that. You see, he got no warning. He got no feeling. He got no way of knowing that. That can be said much simpler than I said it. You can say it in the dust jacket. All the things in college English, you see, have a heading.
Yeah.
Well, just use one of those little college English headings, you see. There's absolutely no law against it. You see, Mr. Hergesheimer, Mr. Kirkpatrick didn't invent it, or you can improvise. But you've still got the problem. Still got the problem. But that little, where was that? Oh, yes! It was from this flathead. You see, his mind works in terms of a crew unloading a 30,000-ton truck. Pound truck. That's the way his mind works. They got somebody upside jerking the things off and throwing them on the roller and all like that, you see. And somebody slices them and somebody taps them and all like that. That's the way his mind works. Well, but he has friction with one of them, Eddie.
Joe.
Mm-hmm. That's all you need. That's all you need. Just unload the damn truck. And there you got friction with Joe. So that the experience itself is destruction.
Yeah.
That's what it was. And you can be just as circumstantial as you want to about unloading the truck. It'd be nice to be circumstantial. See, if it's half, if the truck's half full, it's not so hard. They don't have to, they can lift things down. If it's way up there, see, they got to get the muscle power.
But the thing about it is the friction with you.
Whatever you want. That's whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
It don't matter.
Yeah, Kirkpatrick puts it, well, he says it, you know, that there has to be a crucial moment in everything. But I guess another term for it would be the, you know, just the friction.
Well, it ought to build. But
he uses the term, you know, that it's the current vocabulary, I guess, or it just, that's what they use in that class, to make sense out of things. So if he reads a story about a woman who has trouble with a roof, he wants to see her trying to make sense out of the world, he possibly, to put order into it. And if I put it in his term, I'd say that's what her talk does. You know, she's looking at it. That's in her terms, but his terms.
Yes. Let him distort it a good bit. You see, they're clear out of the element in dealing with reality, with something that's factual. Slice of life, as you say.
Well, he says you don't want to deal with someone who's real. You came out and said that. If you take a real person, and you've gotten yourself into more problems than you can ever get yourself out of. You have to take her apart and recreate somebody. You can't, I guess he overstates it. I'm sure. It doesn't seem like you can say you can't use a real person. Because that's.
Yeah. Well, now you want to get that down now.
That's down. I wrote it down.
And just prolong it.
Yeah.
Go along with him. But you got to keep thinking on the other side too, in order to let him enable him to think, and that it is possible, you see, for him to see possibility. That he won't stay with the Yates, Ransom, Elliot faction forever. It'd be hard because you see he don't have enough muscle. He don't. He doesn't get out in the sunlight.
He used to. This is what amazes me about him. I'd like to hear him talk just about what he's done. He used to be in the Merchant Marine. He left home at 17 and took off.
Yeah, I've heard some of them been in the Navy, too.
Well, I think it might.
Who can tell you everything that happened? Well, you are there to listen.
Yeah,
sure. It'll cost you a little bit. You can make a scene, but it's your own enterprise, you know.
I know. Don't remind me.
I'm a rubby nose. Now, let me see, Suzanne. You've never been through the divinity school yet.
Yeah, we went through it. And then the Emerson class.
Yes, but we didn't get that far. But I've been through it on the outside. And it's a booger. It is a booger. Now, what did you say you had been through?
Detroit,
fate,
and experience.
Just those three.
Well, self-reliance and the American scholar.
Oh, you went back through them?
Yeah.
Oh, did you?
Well, yeah.
Did you get it straight, what he said?
Huh? Well, I see. I got on self-reliance, I got one side from Picard, and then the side we've been working through. I'm not real sure if I got it straight or not.
You got his straight, I mean.
I think so. Man, I told you I caught him real. He was going to leave him for a class. So it was only about 10 minutes, so we didn't get very far with it. But the main thing, he said first of all, he didn't use Franklin. He uses Franklin with Thoreau all the time. But he said what happens, he uses that idea that the nonconformity has to be, he said, spiritual rather than mental. And that the main thrust of the essay is that it's not that we're nonconformists, but that we conform to a deeper reality. And we have to, our self-reliance, as he calls it, is actually not self-reliance at all, not reliance on ourselves, but on this immense intelligence that surrounds us and motivates the world.
Mm-hmm.
So when he talks about self-reliance, he's not talking about that at all. He's talking about a reliance and a trust in this and a conformity to the he said you can use the oversoul if you want to call it, or what Emerson called them. So being reality, he said Emerson never really says exactly what it is. He says you can't. Emerson didn't think he could. And that's about all he said then. I haven't seen him again on something because he was leaving. But he said, you know, it is in Platonic terms. He said that it's... he mentioned that so much of philosophy seems to come down to two arguments. Two main arguments. Is there a sort of a universal model for things, a reality, of which this world is just a shadow, a shade, and this particulars?
Well, now, it's going to be interesting to see how that carries over into Whitman.
Well, what I remember of Whitman, they do it. They do carry it over into Whitman, that side of it.
Well, you've got to start with a song myself. Mm. You can't start with his poems of his old age.
I had Dr. Spivey with Whitman, and we spent about 2 weeks on him. And we used Song of Myself, Lilacs, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. That one where he's listening to the bird on the shore that lost its mate. I can't remember the name of it. Out of the Cradle, Endlessly Rocking. And one other one, which is, you know, is cosmic optimism, they call it. And I think that's where they pick up Emerson, you know, that side of Emerson again. That the optimism is based on this belief in a deeper reality than people can see themselves. And this is the approach Picard takes to Thoreau, too. Partly. He's fascinating looking to on Thoreau. It's really kind of fun. Because he lines it out for the first part.
You see, when you were listening to Dr. Spivey, you let him jump from Emerson's metaphysics and skip all of the early Whitman.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not real sure which is the late and which is the early. I guess Song of Myself is the earliest, and then Song of the Open Road is early too, isn't it?
Well, you can get an 1855 edition of the Song of Myself. You can call it early or whatever you want to call it. It's the first thing he ever did. And he set it up and printed it himself. And then Emerson wrote that letter and he put that in and got out a second edition. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that long foregrip.
Yeah. And it's got the 1855 prefaced too, you see. And you want the 1855 preface and not the remodeled one. He remodeled a little bit as he went along, I think.
So. Well, you see what Dr. Spivey does and what Dr. Picard does, and the same thing Dr. Kirkpatrick does. I think sometimes, if they could, they would ignore the thought altogether and just work on the art and the thing. Picard says that. In Emerson, you can't deal with the thought, or just barely. You can try to say what's there and all. He says, but for most people today, for the modern world, it simply doesn't apply. He just becomes ridiculous in his. He calls his optimism. So what they do, they look at him artistically and judge him on that. How well he structured a poem and.
And then passed it on to somebody else.
Yeah. And what sort of metaphors he uses, and, you know, the structure. You know.
Yeah, that's one way of taking the intros out.
And last night, when he worked on Thoreau, what he does, this is sort of his working method, he takes passages, which is, you know, that's about the best way sometimes. And he took that passage, the mass and men leave lives with quiet desperation. He spent 30 minutes on that, like so.
Yeah.
Just examining the nuances of the words.
You put down?
Yeah. That's what's nice about Dr. Picard. He can take notes so easily. Not just sit there and listen with one ear and write, you know, at the same time. No problem. Very convenient.
What is it about? What would you say about that?
Not about the passage?
Yeah.
Well, he said he starts out with the word mass. He says right away, there you get an impression of something solid, and immovable, heavy. You know. That's what he does.
Well,
if we
get into that.
Okay. You thought so.
Now you got all those brains. All those brains. Just take all the heart out of Emerson.
Well, God, when you look at, like you say, they don't. He plays tennis, and he's in this Save Historic Gainesville program, and he serves on the committees for the junior college and the graduate assistant teaching program that they're trying to develop, he and Hellstrom. I don't know what else he does. And he, you know, he works on his classes and his book or whatever he's writing right now on Whittier. You know, how else could he look at it but just artistically?
Well, that's it.
And the students do it too. The students do it too.
Just take all the content out.
We can't throw it.
All the content out. You see?
That's why it's the
only following I ever had in my life, and I've had it since way before World War II, was with Emerson. As if he had no content, no appeal, you see.
Well, he just came out and said that you it was almost impossible to use Emerson with the undergraduates. You could use Thoreau, and maybe go from Thoreau into Emerson, but you simply, for the majority of students, you couldn't. Now, it could be true, but I think he feels the same way about the graduate students, that Emerson is just, you can't handle it unless you use the poems.
That's what you get into these days in the study of literature. That's literature. And what you get all these brilliant flatheads, you see, who just take it right down and hand it back. Just dozens at a time who do it.
By the system.
And the thing about it is,
they don't help them. They just go right along with them.
And Suzanne has to go through all this.
Go through it. I've done it, and I did it without thinking about it either. Well, you saw those papers I wrote for Dr. Picard.
I can remember Ward Hellstrom getting up when I had him in class. He kind of smiled. And then he'd start with the biggest rigmarole you've ever heard about Tennyson, and he'd smile and go, "Now do you believe that?" And you see all these pencils just stop and look at him like, "Have you lied to us? Have you lied to us?" And he'd laugh and he'd say, "Don't you want to ask me any questions?"
Oh, they don't. They just want to get a grade and do our next part. I tell you, we're going to have some fun. We're going to have a session with Ms. D's. We got to have a session with her.
I expect she probably do pretty well. She can drown out Miss Mary. I'm certain she can.
Well, I always say that they went right along together. Yeah. But she sat over there and talked about that moon. She wasn't sure. She wasn't. They hadn't proved to her yet.
You should.
What's that?
They wore those big balloony suits because they pump them up and they float around in them.
Yeah, that's what makes them buoyant.
They wouldn't have to go out in Arizona, because I've seen, if she knew about this, she'd really have a fit. Out there at the Space Center in Houston, they've got an area fenced off that is a replica of the moon, and they move it around to look like the area they're going to land in, and it's it looks like it. And you can see they have a lunar, the landing craft out there, parked out there, and they practice riding the dune buggy around out there. I think of my father's side of it. Lord help us. If you got him in here, he'd talk for hours.
What's that?
If you got my father in here, he'd talk for hours on the space program.
Yeah.
He just loves it. And Boeing to the side and Jobs and Perosh is not what's coming. He still loves it. He gets all excited about it.
I don't blame him.
And Jeff sat in there and watched him take off from the moon. And he just sat there hugging his knees. He was so excited. I've never seen anything like it.
Don't he ever tape any of his programs? Huh? He just listens. there was an hour program on after the evening news the other night with, I don't know, Peter Ustinov.
Ustinov and Marshall McLuhan.
Yes. McLuhan was rich, wasn't he?
Oh, he
was. Well, now you see, you got no chance to call that program unless you tape it. You see, I taped it, and I've listened to the first 5 minutes several times, and I can't get any farther.
Well, because I've got that tape recorder sitting right next to each other.
Yeah.
We got us a TV finally.
Well, you don't have much chance for TV. It's your stage. You've got a lot of other things to do.
Yeah.
But even so, you ought to have some of that mental tools. Let me tell you, Suzanne. I wouldn't do Hawthorne. Or just with a Lincoln promise, they never get it straight. I think the most interesting one is that fella at the beginning. What's his name? Who brings up? He's one of the early ones who raises the question about Hawthorne, and he's serious about it. See, that Hawthorne had no experience and no art.
Spiller.
Yeah, and that's rich, that's good, and that opens it up. And Hawthorne's art is in question, and his experience. Now, what you get into a little later, you see, is let me see. I think that's in Spiller. You see. He makes up the girl. He makes, you see, she, the one thing called Miss Mary and Shirley. I just talked to them. You see, this is beautiful. This is just beautiful. You see, that first view of Hester, you see, no one ever notices it. No one ever notices it. And it is a remarkable visit view, you see. It's nothing like that in all of Hawthorne. You see, he borrows her. He borrows her. But all these great literary products, you see, of this great university never see where they borrow her. And it's just visible, you see, just pure, just plain out in the open. She's the great lady of the Renaissance, Portia, in The Merchant of Venice. That's where he borrows her. And she's Emersonian. He thinks of her as Emersonian. But Hawthorne simply will not get out on a limb.
Yeah, he almost takes back what he says about it.
So he takes it all back. And old Dufourny shows that. Old Spiller.
Yeah.
Now Spiller don't know much. He just opening it up. But that terminology, the art that he had to work with. And I think Hawthorne's art, you see, your academic view of these things is always so, it puts you in such a disadvantage. Hawthorne doesn't have much art. He gets as clumsy as he can be compared to Hemingway or Faulkner or those people. He just, his narrative is just as slow-pokey, you see, and it's hardly a narrative, it's an essay, but you see, it's so difficult, and it's very hard, and if you take it up, just sort of do it for your own benefit and look at it and then move on and don't ask them any questions. Just ask them what the witch lady was doing that night, you see, when somebody died, or you know, something that don't bother them. They don't get that. Hawthorne's very difficult. He's so difficult. He don't know himself, you see.
Yeah, there's another article in there in Carpenter, and he picks up the term, you know, traditional and romantic and transcendental views of it.
Yeah, he does it in a sort of piecemeal way, doesn't he?
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, you know, little definitions to go in each part.
Yeah.
You know, the
but
sin for the
good. Huh?
Spiller and let's see, I think Spiller has that the allegory, this idea of Hawthorne thinking of himself as a romanticist, writing a romance.
The romance,
yeah.
Not a romantic. It's just his
romance.
The term was romance.
Yeah.
He wasn't a novel. He didn't write a novel. He wrote a romance,
yeah.
And a romance put in these little things like Matthew Maule had blood to drink, you know, just something to please a reader who wasn't a very good reader. And he does that deliberately, you see. He cultivates that.
Well, he has Mrs. Hibbins and
the
Comet in the Sky.
Yes, he has a good bit of that. But you see, this one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen anywhere, and I've not seen much. I mean, I'm not a good reader. And I got help on this from Randall Stewart. Oh, yes, that article.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the great moment. And you see, that's one I missed. Now, he missed, Randall Stewart missed a good bit too, I think. I read with him for a semester. Well, he was a gentleman. You see, that at the end, you see, the transfiguration of Dimmesdale. Now that, you see, and where Dimmesdale rises above all this petty stuff they've been going through there, you see, and he's ready to meet the maker, however, I forget the terminology of it, but he rises above it. But he's weak, you see, and his conception of Dimmesdale as a Puritan is he's way past me. But his view of Hester, I think, is sad. It's sad. So you see, you've got things all mixed up in that, and they couldn't possibly get them straight, I don't know what I'd even read it, just read something else. I think you're. I don't think it'd help you. It won't fit into anything. Also, I'm just going out. But now you see your Moby Dick up to the quarter deck. You see, that's, he's a man of this world, and there's nothing transcendental about that, or the Oversoul, anything. It's he's a man of this world. And you see, that picture of Ishmael, and just the glimpse that you get of Ahab, you see, that's the thing that you stay with the rest of your life. I mean, that picture.